Argument is Byrne versus Avon, Ms. Hubbard.
May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Hubbard. I'm the attorney for John Byrne, the appellant. We are seeking a reversal of the grant of summary judgment by the district court to Avon. We are requesting that the case be remanded pursuant to Rule 35 for trial. John Byrne was an employee in need of a medical leave. He had returned from Ireland in October of 1998 after having been an exemplary employee at Avon for approximately 4 years. He was suffering from depression, from lack of concentration and sleep disturbances. He hadn't slept for days and in fact discovered by Avon sleeping in the carpenter's shop, which was a break room for the employees. John Byrne was very sick and he needed FMLA leave. The FMLA was passed.
Was he so sick, or rather, would the evidence permit trier of fact to conclude that he was so sick that he couldn't ask for leave?
I believe the evidence would demonstrate that he was so sick he could not ask for leave.
What would be the best evidence from your perspective for that proposition?
The best evidence from my perspective is the conversation later in the afternoon on November 17th that John Byrne had with his supervisor, Mr. Sparks. In that conversation, Byrne repeated words. He was asked by Sparks, "Do you have a fever?" And his response was, "Fever, fever, fever."
When is November 17 in this sequence?
November 17 was the day that Mr. Sparks and the decision maker, Greg Korak, had decided to meet with John Byrne.
This was the very end, in other words.
This was the very end.
Yeah, the question I was asking is really, before he started sneaking off and sleeping on the job, or at the very beginning of this period. It's clear that at the end of this period, he was totally out of it. But toward the beginning, instead of sleeping on the job, did he have the sufficient mental wherewithal to have been able to approach his supervisor and say, "I need leave"?
I think his condition was an escalating one that he did not recognize what was happening to him. He had not sought medical treatment prior to the 17th. I think it is an argument Avon could make to a jury, and a reasonable jury could conclude one way or the other on that issue. But he had not been medically diagnosed by November 17th when he was taken to the hospital and was admitted for a week with a diagnosis of severe depression. The district court, in its half-page denial on the FMLA claim, states, "Byrne argues that Avon's failure to grant him FMLA leave when it learned he was hospitalized violated FMLA. But a conclusive and fatal flaw in that position is that FMLA does not protect employees whose discharge would have occurred despite FMLA leave entitlement." Avon is here making that identical argument to you. When I was writing the reply brief, I put Super Personnel Department into Lexis and came up with 863 hits.
Yeah, that's not a productive research.
We understand that the courts do not sit a Super Personnel Department.
Right. Now, let me ask you one more question that I think is pertinent to this. FMLA leave is unpaid.
That's correct.
And your argument here is effectively an argument for retroactive FMLA leave. Basically claims the last two weeks that really got him in trouble and led to his discharge were weeks he took on unpaid FMLA leave in the workplace. Now, does that imply a requirement to tender back the wages and say, "I want to convert it from, you know, taking your money but not doing any work, that's a dischargeable offense, to really being on FMLA leave during those 2 weeks?"
My argument is that Avon interfered with his right to take FMLA leave, that there was no decision made to terminate him.
Let's address my question the way I put it. Right? If an employee says, look, the last 2 weeks before I was fired, I agree, I didn't do a lick of work, I was totally incapable of working. I was so incapable that I was even incapable of asking for FMLA leave. I'm entitled to 12 weeks of FMLA leave in a year. Those two last weeks, instead of being treated as a dischargeable offense, should be treated as FMLA leave. Does that person have an obligation to tender back the wages so that he's no longer being paid for what's supposed to be unpaid leave?
Well, in the purest sense, perhaps. But classically, employees run FMLA leave concurrently with other entitlements,
well,
such as vacation.
If he wants to be paid, it wasn't FMLA leave. If he wants to be paid for those weeks, then the district court's analysis says he wasn't capable of working, he did not a lick of work. That's based on which he can be discharged.
That is not, in all due respect, really what the record is. The record does not say or establish that he was not working. What the record establishes is that Avon had some videotape of a few hours showing that he was in the carpenter shop. The problem Avon has here...
Well, look, if he was capable of doing some work, he was capable of asking for FMLA leave. Your argument that he was so knocked out, he was so depressed, that he couldn't even ask for leave implies that he couldn't work. One can't have things both ways.
But when he did ask for leave, Avon interfered with that right. The rules of engagement change when John Byrne asked for leave, which he did. And Avon's response was, we're firing you.
When did he ask for leave? I missed that.
He asked numerous times for leave, and his family members asked for leave. There were 8 to 10 conversations during the morning and afternoon of November 17th between Burns.
None of them asked involved a request for leave.
They were advising Avon that he had to get to a hospital, that they had to get him to a doctor. Avon has obligations here. They do not get the luxury or the right to stand on formalities in terms of an employee's request. There's no magic language for Avon to say, this is triggering, now, our obligations under FMLA. They are being told, John Byrne is going to the hospital. John Byrne is very, very sick. He's too sick to talk to you. We have to get him to a doctor. He's mumbling. He's repeating words. He cannot coherently talk to his supervisor.
Well, Judge Shader said in spite of all that, he was fired for his deficiencies before any of this happened, right?
There was no intention to terminate John Byrne before the point in time when he left to go to the hospital. They just wanted to talk to him to get his side of the story, to find out what it was that had shown up on the videos. No termination papers were made. There was no decision made that John Byrne would be fired.
Without his sleeping on the job and so forth, he wouldn't have been fired. So that's true. That was a sine qua non of his discharge.
And in fact, if you look at A131, the human resources supervisor said, had we learned about the hospital stay, had we learned about his disabilities, that may preclude termination. It factors into how we discipline. It may very well be the preclusion of any discipline if we had known John Byrne was so sick and in need of FMLA.
I totally agreed with you that there was a violation of the FMLA, but disagreed with you about the ADA. What would be the relief you would be seeking, if anything?
If the case were remanded, it would remand on the basis of the FMLA alone for trial. The damages are certainly different under FMLA than they are under the ADA. As you know, there are no statutory caps that are in place.
What would they be?
The damages would be his entitlement to take the leave and his right to be reemployed, at which point, if they have...
I'm assuming he has no ADA claim, that he was properly terminated. because he couldn't do the work. So,
he could do the work had he been given a reasonable accommodation under the ADA.
And that's your ADA argument.
That's correct.
Suppose we reject that. Suppose we agree he has no, with the district judge, he has no ADA claim. Is there any separate relief that you would get under FMLA?
The separate relief would be the fact that he is entitled to reinstatement after his 12 weeks of FMLA leave, and he was not reinstated. At that point, the back pay starts to run. It's analogous to the ADEA and how the damages are calculated. But, I'm sorry, I'm out of time.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hubbard. Mr. Dale?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is James Bales, and I represent the defendant, Avon Products, Inc. On November 17, 1998, Avon discharged John Byrne because he repeatedly and flagrantly misused company time. He had been caught red-handed on videotape, repeatedly abandoning his critical post in Avon's boiler room and sleeping for as much as 5 hours of his standard 8-hour shift in a locked room in Avon's Morton Grove plant. Byrne, as
but
he
by November 17th, didn't they realize he had a psychiatric problem?
No, Your Honor. Actually, nobody at Avon by November 17th had any inkling whatsoever that Byrne had a psychiatric problem.
Not. Here's somebody who it apparently is agreed was a fine employee for an extended period who suddenly goes haywire. How can one not suspect that there's a psychiatric problem?
Well, the problem, Your Honor, is that what Avon's, or what Byrne's family knew is not the same thing as what Avon knew.
No, I'm just describing what Avon knew. Here's somebody who was a fine, diligent, conscientious employee for an extended number of years who suddenly starts sleeping on the job. Now, what wouldn't one suspect that there was either a physical or a psychological problem coming up?
I don't necessarily think that that is so, Your Honor.
You know, if I've been sitting here for 18 years hearing oral arguments. Suppose suddenly I start dozing off in the middle of oral arguments. Maybe there's been a sudden change in the quality of advocacy at the bar, but more likely I've suffered a stroke or am having a psychiatric problem. I mean, wouldn't one suspect that as a possibility?
Again, Your Honor, I don't necessarily agree with that. The FMLA does not require employers to be clairvoyant. There could have been all kinds of reasons.
I wasn't suggesting clairvoyance. It's a pretty straightforward explanation of such things.
Well, again, Your Honor...
Once Holmes started sleeping on the bench, nobody concluded that he was a slacker. They concluded that he'd had a stroke, which he had.
Well, Byrne, though, Mr. Byrne was not simply falling asleep on the job. It's not as if he fell asleep in the boiler room. John Byrne consciously got up, walked to an area of the plant in which he is ordinarily not supposed to be, locked himself in a room, and slept. And it wasn't that he was just nodding off. He'd read, he'd put his feet up, he'd sleep for a while, he'd leave the boiler room, he'd go back to his post, he'd come back to the...
But it seems that the company wanted to investigate the situation and that they only decided to fire him when they learned that he was going to the hospital.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not quite sure that that chronology of the events is borne out by the record either. It's pretty clear that as of November 16th, the morning of November 16th, Avon had completed its investigation into Mr. Byrne's misconduct. They had
Why
him on
did
video.
They summon him to a meeting on the 17th?
It was, well, the 17th actually was his first shift after the morning of the 16th. His shift began at 10 o'clock p.m. on the 16th. The chronology of the events was that Byrne was videotaped the evening and morning of Wednesday, the 11th, Thursday, the 12th and Friday the 13th. Once the last tape had been reviewed on the morning of November 16th, it was at that point that Greg Korek, Sparks, and Brenda Lemire of Human Resources met to discuss what they found. At that time, Ms. Lemire recommended that Byrne be discharged. Sparks had already voted that Byrne be discharged. At this point, there was no evidence whatsoever that there was anything wrong with Mr. Byrne.
Well, Korek said he hadn't made up his mind, though, didn't he?
Well,
isn't Korek, he's the top boss here. He calls the shots, doesn't he?
Well, he was the top boss, and he did call the shots in this circumstance. But
I mean, let's take it for granted or agree with you that they had grounds for firing this fellow. They could have fired him. But what is relevant here? Whose state of mind is relevant? Is anybody's state of mind relevant? What's the law about to determine who, what? Is it sufficient to say, well, he had grounds for firing him, even though subjectively that may not have been what they had in mind when they scheduled the meeting?
Well, that's an interesting question, Your Honor. And in entitlement cases, pretext is not part of the analysis. So, if they had grounds to fire him, then they are allowed to go forward and do that, unless Mr. Byrne could come forward with enough evidence to say that, in fact, no, it was my request for leave that got me fired instead of my misconduct. But at the time, the decision, at least for two of the three players that were involved.
But the decision was made on the 17th.
That's correct, Your Honor. The decision was made on the 17th. But what Avon knew as of the 17th was very limited. First of all, unlike...
It knew something else that it didn't know on the 16th, and it seems to have swung Korek, or at least a jury could think that.
I'm not sure that they really did know more on the 17th.
The fact that he didn't show up at the meeting was that was tipped the scales. And I mean, they may not have decided to fire him before that, but when he didn't show up, they thought that was the signal to fire him.
Well, there's no evidence in the record at all from either Sparks or Korek, who was supposed to meet with Mr. Byrne, that he was discharged because he didn't show up for the meeting. Both witnesses were unequivocal that he was discharged.
Well, Korek said they had made up their mind before the meeting to fire him, right?
Well, Korek had indicated that he wanted to hear Byrne's side of the story.
Well, that suggests he might have been... He wasn't committed to firing, unless he just listens for the psychological value of listening.
Well, every other, though, employee who had been charged with similar offenses had been fired as well. And so it's not, I think, clear in the record, or even a reasonable inference, that Korek would have changed his mind depending on what John Byrne told him. Mr. Byrne's immediate supervisor had already made up his mind. Human Resources had already blessed it. And although Korek wanted to hear his side of the story, they already had Byrne's side of the story. They had him on videotape. I don't think that talking to Mr. Byrne was any more part of the investigation than asking a man standing in front of a firing squad whether he has any last words. The fact remains that Mr. Byrne's misconduct was documented, it was clear, every other employee who had ever been charged with a similar infraction was fired. I think it would be an unreasonable inference to conclude that Korek would have made a different decision based on what Mr. Byrne may or could have said to him. In any event, it's irrelevant because Byrne wasn't there to say his side of the story.
Well, suppose Byrne's sister had said, you know, I think Byrne's a psychotic. I think he's psychotically depressed, and he ought to be in a mental institution. Could they have gone ahead and fired him for sleeping on the job in that case?
They could, under Coles. They could very well do that because the decision to fire Mr. Byrne was not predicated on the notion that he would take leave, but on the notion that Mr. Byrne had acted badly. and that is not illegal under this court's jurisprudence, and it is not illegal under the FMLA, because the FMLA is quite clear that employees have no greater right to their job than they would have if they hadn't gone on leave.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bale.
Thank you.
Hubbard, how much time does she have? No time. Well, you want a minute? You can have a minute.
The FMLA was passed by Congress to provide people with job security to deal with a serious health condition. It is for a reasonable jury to decide what, if anything, CORAC would have done. CORAC says, I simply wanted to get John Thorne's side of the story, and then I was going to decide what to do. It is unfair for Avon to come to this court and try to portray this as a done deal. It was not. The intervening event was John Byrne saying in his mumbling, inarticulate way, I've got to get to a doctor. His nephew saying, my parents are taking him to Lutheran General. And his sister saying, he's very, very sick. I'm trying to trick him out of the locked room that he's in to get him to the hospital. Sparks on the 17th says that he's called Lutheran General to ascertain whether or not John Byrne's even there and can't confirm that he's an inpatient. I would contend the decision, in fact, was not even made until the 18th. I see my time is up.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Hubbard and Mr. Bales. The case will be taken under advisement.